Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour, January 19th, 2023. A few topics tonight on statistics, and I was surprised at this. I just kind of ran across this as I was doing. Sometimes I just do internet searches, etc. When I started looking into this, it was amazing. I just didn't know these things existed in these types of studies. But anyway, this is just data. These are facts. In the United States, 50% of women, young women today, will not have any children. Unbelievable. This is amazing. And so what's going on is, the population, the native population of the United States is just going away. Secondly, very large numbers of men in the ages of, say, 25 to 35, I believe that's the proper age range, and those are the young men looking for wives. A lot of them, just a very high percentage of them, they'll party with American girls, they'll go to college, everything's great, but when it comes to getting married, they don't want to have anything to do with them. They're literally going to foreign countries to find wives. So you combine these two statistics, and the United States is really in a very strange situation. There are other countries too, like China is importing women because they had this no birth policy, no young girl policy. And so they were literally killing little girl babies, 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Now they don't have any women, all of the babies were men. So they have all these men that don't have any available wives. I mean, this is just crazy stuff. But then the next statistic has to deal with divorce. And this, it didn't surprise me, this one, so much, but just the numbers, the sheer numbers, are staggering when you look at this from a societal point of view, that in the United States, 50% of marriages end in divorce. Okay, well, that's believable. That's a pretty absolutely high number. It's really, that's one statistic, but if a young man marries a girl with a college education, their chance of divorce is like 80%. You have almost, you would not gamble at Las Vegas with odds like that. And so it's just staggering. And then if you go to even higher education women, and now the women are initiating the divorces, The prospect for a man marrying a young lady with a college education is not real good. Probably their expectations financially are higher. Here was another interesting statistic that Agassi, what's his first name? The tennis player, Andre Agassi, I think is his first name, Andre. But anyway, he married Brooke Shields, the Barbie of the 90s queen, and the marriage lasted apparently less than 2 years, and he has to pay her over $8 million a month, for her support. My goodness, that probably doesn't sound like a good deal to many people, but these are numbers. This is statistics. You can take it where you want, or you can say anything you want, but this is just staggering statistics that this is why young men today, they're looking at the concept of getting married, having a family, stability thereafter, etc., and their financial future, because this is a financial situation where if they have kids, then that's a financial responsibility for the rest of their lives. and not being able to live with the kids and raise them. And that's where the next statistic comes in. This is more horrendous. When you add these statistics together, looking at the one of them at a time is one thing. Now, let's look at prison statistics. We're looking at hardcore crime where the people are 10, 20, 30-year sentences. These are severe crimes, that are violent crimes, and that's where you get these big numbers. Financial crimes, things like that don't warrant, typically, unless they're ripping off a lot of people or something like. I'm talking about the hardcore crimes of violence. And they did statistics, data studies on prisoners. 99%, I mean, this is just like everybody in this category in prison came from single parent homes. And not only single parent, but single mother homes. Then they did a study to see how many of these hardcore prisoners were raised by single fathers. It was literally 0%. Literally none of them, in other words, if a child is raised in a single-parent home by a father, their chances of being long-term prison violent crime is zero. If their young person is raised by a single mother and ends up in the criminal system, 99.9% that are in these high crime categories were raised by women, by the mother. This is staggering when you combine the divorce statistic with the prison statistics and the fact that the United States has more people in prison for high-level crimes than any other country in the world. Anyway, those are statistics. You can take them for whatever they are worth, but those are real numbers. Okay, next on to the Tonga eruption. This happened about a year ago now. We're 1 year into this eruption. It was an underwater eruption, and so there was a tremendous amount of water involved and ash. So this went up literally into outer space. And then the plume came back down, and it added 13% to the water content in Earth's atmosphere. And it added three times the amount, three times the amount of dust, volcanic ash. This is fine particles up in the upper atmosphere. And if you go out on any night when the sun is shining and the sun goes down and you look into the western sky, you can see very high, a very pinkish color, the pink sunsets. And I remember back in, in the 2000s when I did my 110 photos of the American Southwest. That's a CD that I have available on my website. It's one of my products that I sell. There was a wind that came in from China, and there was a drought in China that brought in a wind and dust. And so anyway, that gave a lot of red sunsets. But that redness is thicker, and it's near the horizon. When you see the sunsets now due to the Tonga plume that's still up there, and by the way, it encapsulated the world in about a couple of weeks. In other words, the Tonga, of course, is near the equator, but when it erupted, the ash cloud spread out and literally encompassed the entire world within 2 weeks. That is incredible, which just a little bit of a caveat here. People who think that nuclear war is okay and it's survivable and it's good and it's, let me tell you something. One nuclear bomb going off any place on the planet, that the uranium, the plutonium in the bomb is going to be worldwide within a couple weeks. So it's not like you're going to be in a safe place. There's no safe place for nuclear bomb fallout. Anyway, the back to the Tonga event. Now, what's going on is we're having global cooling. And I just saw numbers come out. Finally, somebody is doing potentially some real science here. They said there has been no increase in world temperature in the last 8 years. So all of the dire predictions of the Greenland ice cap melting and, you know, a 20-foot rise in sea level at New York City putting everybody underwater simply did not happen. Or Antarctica, the same thing. Antarctica has gotten thicker. The Arctic, the northern polar region, has gotten thicker. It has been doing that for thousands of years. And we are going through a warming period on Earth, and that's because we're coming out of an ice age, boys and girls. We are coming out of an ice age, and that's the situation. But we are experiencing global cooling at a fantastic rate, and I believe that the statistics are being skewed to make it look better than what it really is in terms of cooling. In other words, we are actually dropping temperature by maybe as much as a half a degree Celsius since the Tonga explosion. And so what does that have to do with you? Well, that means that the growing season this spring is going to be shorter. That means the winter this year is going to be more severe and there's going to be more snow. Why is there more snow? Because the atmosphere is colder and the air cannot hold as much water as it used to. Simple chemistry. And so right now the tremendous amount of water that's in the atmosphere is dumping out, plus we have literally three times the amount of water in the atmosphere as we did before, and I'm sorry, 13% more. 13, that's a lot. I remember I was in the XPRIZE, the Water Abundance XPRIZE, and the entire concept there was to extract water from the air. But in doing that, I learned a lot about atmospheric water and the numbers, etc. It turns out that most of the water in the atmosphere, and it's a tremendous amount, I mean, it's oceans worth of water up in the atmosphere, but it's up in the cloud systems, and it's not available down at the surface of the Earth, where you have humidity that's, unless it's raining, in which case you don't need water from the air. If it's raining, there, you're going to get a lot more water just by catchment than you're going to by running a very expensive electric hungry water from the air machine. For example, just to give you an example, the machines that I used for my own product line, they're very efficient. They're the most efficient water generators in the world. They're called atmospheric water generators. AWG is the mnemonic. And so I had two 1,000 liter per day units. They required 12.5 kilowatts of energy to operate each one of those. So that's 25 kilowatts to get 2,000 liters of water per day. So that's a lot of energy, but when it comes from the wing generator, which is running off of wind, then the cost of energy is minimal. So anyway, that was the whole idea of the XPRIZE. But the reality is the majority of water is up in the upper atmosphere in the cloud systems, and really is not accessible to us mere mortal people down here on the surface of the Earth. Okay, so back to just to recap the Tonga eruption. Earth is going through a global cooling right now, a severe global cooling. And if it were to combine with something else, like, say, a dip in the solar radiation, etc., where we do get our heating, from the light from the sun, if that were to change slightly, or the spectrum of the sun would change slightly, where it would offset into, say, the ultraviolet, more energy in ultraviolet, or the other direction, more energy in the infrared in the other direction. Or so if the solar spectrum spread out or broadened or did any of these things, then we would have another factor affecting our overall temperature. And that's what they call climate. But anyway, the world is going to die, the global climate change, people have to pack it up and go home. It has, in all the political footballs going on, it's garbage science. It was garbage science from the beginning, from the day Carl Sagan crawled out from under his rock, or his David Duncan chair of astronomy at Cornell University. From the day that clown put that in motion, it's been bad science ever since. Just want to make a quick comment about space travel and space exploration. And something I've said all along is that rockets, vertical lift, heavy lift rockets, it's one way to get payloads into outer space. But things in space don't have to be heavy. They can be very lightweight if they're made out of carbon fiber, and the ability to make things large out of carbon fiber is increasing. And space manufacturing will actually make that easier in the future. Because when you make something out of carbon fiber, this I have experience with, I actually had an archery company back in the early 90s where I was making the very first carbon fiber archery equipment. And it requires a vacuum or very low pressure and atmospheric pressure. And at the time, the resins required very high physical pressure. And so anyway, all of that has changed with improvements in the technology, etc. But the point is that heavy lift rockets have a tremendous amount of stress on them because you're lifting millions and millions of pounds of fuel. And all that fuel gets expended, and it puts a lot of stress on the airframe, on the rocket structure itself. And because you have these engines that are putting out millions of pounds of thrust, and if you compare that to a jet aircraft that takes off from a runway, that's always been the way to go into outer space. The only issue is that it's been fairly difficult to get big payloads in terms of mass, in terms of kilograms, or in terms of pounds of matter that you can actually get into orbit. And of course, that's where it's all happening, is how much weight can you get into space. And then once you want to get out of low Earth orbit, then you have to you have to have propellant to do that, and typically that's in the form of oxygen, hydrogen, and that's more mass. So that reduces the amount of actual payload you can send up into space very drastically, because it takes a lot of energy. But there again, that's why I invented the electromagnetic propulsion systems, and I talk about that in my book, The Diamond Principle. But the one thing I'm going to tell you, and I'm not going to go into detail here, is that the technologies are emerging for runway to orbit vehicles. And that's something that I've been working on for a long time. So anyway, just a little update there. I'll keep you posted as things develop. I'm not giving out any specific information, but very interesting. Because you can take off from a runway just like you do with a regular airplane. You can either go suborbital to transverse, like, so you can go from New York to Hong Kong in like less than an hour. And also it's very much less expensive in terms of fuel, because with a standard aircraft at 35,000 feet, you're plowing through this heavy atmosphere, and that's why you're only going 600 miles an hour or whatever. Only it seems like a lot more than back in the old propeller days when you were going maybe 300 miles an hour or 250 miles an hour. The flights took longer, but they actually, interestingly enough, used a lot less fuel. When the first flights started in the, I believe it was the 1930s, the mail flights between the mainland and, for example, Hawaii, of course, they didn't have the ability to make runways, so they used the flying boats, they called them. And they were literally a craft that sat in the water, took off from the water, and they were big, physically big. And they would have four or six engines on them, and they would go very slow. So they didn't use up much gasoline, because most of the energy expended, it goes as the square of the velocity. So as you increase velocity, the wind resistance increases, and more than proportionate to the advantage of going faster. And so it takes more gasoline to go fast and get someplace than it does to go slow and get to the same place. There's an interesting story about Charles Lindbergh. He was he had made his famous flight, etc., and he was, in a sense, retired from, he never was really in the military, but World War II came along, and he felt obligated to go serve his country and help out the team, so to speak. So he ended up, from what I understand, in the South Pacific. And he entered a group of flyers, and they were flying the P-48 or the Lightning Bolt. It was, I forget, the P-47, and it was the twin fuselage, high performance jet. It wasn't a jet, but it was, I mean, they could fly 500 miles an hour. And so anyway, he was joined this group, and as the story goes, he was not very popular. They didn't like him. He wasn't one of the guys, so to speak. So he was kind of like off by himself. And then he would fly with them. And he said, hey, you guys are burning up all kinds of fuel getting to your destination. You could go a lot farther if you went slower. And so that expanded the range. It like tripled the range of these fighter planes, which were the most effective fighter planes in World War II. And so anyway, they literally tripled their range that they could go on a tank of gas, and opened up all kinds of operations that they could perform in the military. So then he became well-liked by his peers. And even though he was never he was never truly in the military. Interesting story. But anyway, back to the idea of taking off from a runway, the fuel savings is phenomenal. And you look at a rocket, a vertical lift rocket, it's using about 50% of that fuel by the time it gets up to cruising altitude for a 747. Richard Branson is going the runway to orbit route, but he just had another failure. It wasn't due to the launch system. It wasn't due to the 747. That the rocket simply failed to make orbit, and it had five satellites on it. So he had two devastating setbacks in his space program in the last month. About a month ago, I reported that he had a death. A pilot actually died when they were re-entering. They were doing a practice run with his Virgin Galactic tourism spacecraft, and so I talked about that a couple of weeks ago. But anyway, just my opening comment was that the technologies are moving in the direction of runway to orbit types of payloads. And so anyway, very exciting, something that is going to move in the direction that I believe will ultimately be the winner. Like when I talked about hydrogen, actually is the first time I talked about hydrogen being the true winner in the energy industry. Everybody was doing electric vehicles. Everybody thought hydrogen was out there to lunch. You know, it wasn't going to work. And I knew, because I had run the numbers and all of the numbers about hydrogen, and I said, no, hydrogen is the clear winner here. If you take away all of the infrastructure related to oil and gasoline and diesel and the refineries and the derricks out in the middle of the Gulf, drilling and all of the activity that you need to get a barrel of oil, compare that to a barrel of hydrogen, and there's just no comparison. And then you have this complicated internal combustion engine that you have to use for diesel or gasoline or for locomotives, etc. Tremendously complicated, and compare that to hydrogen, which is a relatively simple engine and much less prone to failure, all kinds of things. So no, hydrogen wins hands down. And in that same vein, runway to outer space wins hands down, over any other type of launch system. And as far as getting heavy payloads into outer space, that will come with time. But payloads are getting smaller and smaller and weighing less and less. And that's part of the ticket of getting runway to outer space, is to have things that just don't weigh that much. And that's coming also. So anyway, all the technologies for runway to space are coming along nicely. And I suspect, just to give a time frame, within 2 years, you will see major launch systems going up from the runway. The other thing that it does, as is pointed out by a lot of the companies working in this region, is that there's a lot less stress on the satellite. A lot less stress on the satellite, and that's very important. It's very important to be able to build a satellite, because once the satellite's up in outer space, it really doesn't require much strength, because there's no stress on it. There's no wind. There's nothing. It's just there. And you can have a sheet of Mylar, and it sits there for a long time, years and decades, without any deterioration. A lot of the structure of a satellite today is to withstand the launch itself, the tremendous vibration and forces, etc., that go along with a launch that is from a launch pad in the form of a rocket. So anyway, runway to orbit is the way of the future, and like I say, it's moving along nicely. So in a few years, we're going to see a bourgeoning of this type of industry. Okay, switching gears just a little bit here, talking about galaxies, one of our very favorite topics here. It turns out that my very first peer-reviewed published paper when I was at Cornell was dealing with galactic evolution. And I also have my space science course online here, DVD number 4, it's called, on my webpage. One of the striking things about galaxies, and it always impressed me, was the symmetry. And the standard theoretical explanation for galaxies, it is, they say it's like a record disc. The arm shapes are there and it goes around and around. But it violates Newton's laws, because that's not the way gravity works. Gravity gets less, the force becomes less and less. It's 1/r² force, if you want to know exactly the equation, but it's 1/r² force. So as you get, like, for example, if you get twice as far away from a star or the Earth or whatever physical object in outer space, if you get twice as far away, the force is 1/4. If you get 3 times as far away, the force is 1/9. 4 times away, 1/16, so it drops off very quickly. It's 1/r² force. Okay, so it's not possible for something to spin in a gravitational system like a record disk. So that doesn't make any sense. So then they have to create missing mass. They say, well, is all this mass orbiting the galaxy that we can't see, and that's what changes things, but it's just... it gets goofy. These are the biggest problem with astronomers is they're very poor physicists. And that goes for a lot of the people who are physicists, who have physics degrees, who are astronomers too, because they recite these ridiculous mimes that have no possibility of being correct. But the way they claim this gets started is by some external impulse. And here's where it really goes awry, is that any external impulse is not coming in at the dust cloud in the galactic nucleus perfectly symmetrical all the time. It's going to come in at an angle or relative to the angular momentum vector of the dust cloud around the nucleus. And so at any rate, to get the symmetry you see in galaxies is impossible with a standard theory of how galaxies form. So what I did is I said, well, that's one of the primary observations that we have to account for. So I developed my paper, and it got published. It was peer-reviewed. And so anyway, the whole political industry of astronomy has never changed. They still stick with that stupid something hit it. It's kind of like the NASA and asteroid hit it explanation for everything that happens. If there's a magnetic field fluctuation, oh, an asteroid must have hit it. If a comet brightens, oh, an asteroid must have hit it. In fact, I've got a chapter by that title in my new book. I'll talk about the new book in a few minutes here. But anyway, back to galaxies. So symmetry, this amazing, amazing symmetry, exists in galaxies. In other words, if you take a photograph of a galaxy and you take a ruler, just take a ruler and lay it on the photograph with the nucleus of the galaxy along that ruler, and you just go out in any direction, the exact same distance from the nucleus, you will find star clusters, you will find voids, you will find physical attributes of the galaxy exactly the same on both sides of the galaxy. So how did this happen? So symmetry is an essential part of understanding how galaxies work. So anyway, I've been, this is something that happens when you're making discoveries, is that every now and then a new insight comes along and you go, what about that? And I had some really great insights into the formation of galaxies. Now, if you go to any article, modern article about galaxies, mainly they'll probably be talking about black holes at the center of the galaxy. And or videos or some astronomer or whatever talking about galaxies, they'll tell you that there's a black hole there. And that's pretty much standard theme now. And what I'm about to tell you is, no, there is no black hole there. And there's no reason for there being a black hole there. It's how the gravitational model works. And so at any rate, what they're doing is not understanding the total mass that's visible in the system, in the star systems that surround the galactic nucleus. So at any rate, there is no need for a black hole at the center of a galaxy. And the reason they believe that is because all this stuff, all of these stars, including our own sun and the Milky Way, are orbiting this galactic nucleus. So you would think in a typical gravitational system, like let's compare it to the sun and the nine planets, including Pluto, little Pluto out there. Jupiter is 1/10 the diameter of the sun. However, something very interesting, that the mass of the sun, if you take the total mass of the solar system and you look at it, the sun has 99.86% of all the mass in the solar system. Jupiter has the majority of the rest of the mass of the whole solar system, and the other planets, and Saturn, which is a small unlit star, by the way, not a planet. If you take the Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, and then jump across Jupiter, because we're trying to add up all of the rest of the mass of the solar system. So it would be beyond Jupiter. There you have Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. So those planets make up just a drop in the bucket, literally nothing, less than 0.01% of the mass of the solar system. So the sun and Jupiter make up the bulk of the mass, but the sun is 99.86% of the mass of the solar system. So literally everything is orbiting the sun. And it wobbles just a little bit due to the mass of Jupiter orbiting it on a 10-year cycle. Okay, now let's look at a galaxy. This is really, really, really different. Let me say really another time. Really different. Because the bulk of the matter in the galaxy is not necessarily in the nucleus. And this is the key to understanding. Where the belief that there has to be a black hole at the center of the universe, the center of the galaxy, is because you have all of this matter, all of these stars and star systems orbiting this nucleus. So you think, oh, well, wow, it must have all this mass in that center, but it's different. A galaxy mass distribution is very much different than a star system mass distribution. And this is one of the big things that I understood from the very beginning. So you do not need a black hole at the center of a galaxy to stabilize it. Anyway, then there's some other studies coming along dealing with the spectral properties of nuclei. And I'm not going to talk about that on the air because I don't want to give any NASA scientists good ideas for their next published paper, which happens too many times. But at any rate, that's something I'll be talking about as this topic develops. But like I say, you do not need a black hole at the center of the galaxy, some kind of massive, supermassive object. And the things they're observing are explainable in other terms. Okay, this next topic is a follow-up from last week. I talked about a comet that's currently in the solar system. There's a couple of them, actually. So people who have been following this comet K2, it's down below the solar system right now. I talked about it a few weeks ago that on, April in 2025, I think it's going to come back up through the solar system, the plane of the planets, and called the ecliptic. The ecliptic is actually the plane of Earth's orbit around the sun, which is not the same plane as all of the planets, but it's close. So anyway, we measure our vision of the solar system from the plane of Earth's orbit, which, by the way, is constantly changing, just ever so slightly. And what is happening is Jupiter is constantly pulling the planets into its orbital plane. The comet K2 will, like I say, 2025, April, a couple of years from now, will be coming up through the ecliptic and will be about at the orbit of Saturn when this happens, although Saturn will not be in that region of the solar system at the time, but it has a perfect electrical alignment with the planet, with the star, the small unlit brown dwarf star Jupiter. Okay, so, but the comet I talked about last week, it's called, the designation is C2022E3, and it's currently getting a lot of press. It's got a beautiful green halo around it, so there's basically three structures that one could see with small binoculars, or potentially, they say, the naked eye, if you knew exactly where to look for it. But there's the green halo, which is a spherical ball that surrounds the comet nucleus. So no matter what angle you look from, you see this sphere around the nucleus that goes way out. I mean, these extend way out, and that is the hydrogen Debye shield of the electrically charged comet nucleus. But it's just hilarious to see these dirty snowball geeks talking about this and not having a clue why there should be this big ball of material out there. Then they say, well, it's cyanide, which is absurd because there's not enough cyanide in a comet tail to even see. Very difficult to determine the cyanide. And besides, cyanide doesn't even have a green line in its spectrum. But then they say, oh, well, it's a carbon green line. Well, a carbon green line is very different in, once again, molecular carbon. C2, in other words, two carbon atoms hooked together, is a very rare molecule, certainly not in a sufficient abundance to see this cloud, which is visible to the naked eye from, 46 million miles away. What it is a green, it's the green hydrogen line is what it is. It's the hydrogen, and comet probes have been out around comet nuclei, and they can measure the hydrogen, so they know it's there. But they're just all in denial. These astronomers are so lame, it's beyond belief. So that's the first signature of this particular comet. Then the second one is the dust tail, which is dust and material being drawn into the comet nucleus. And this consists of basically space dust, all kinds of stuff, fine little dust particles that are ionized and move very slowly in towards the comet nucleus. And then there's what they call the ion tail, which is a beeline out away in the sunward or anti-sunward direction. It's on the opposite side of the sun, but in a beeline that's going out into space. And that extends out for maybe 10 to 100 million miles, really long. And that is the electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. But they call it, I don't even want to talk about standard science. It's so goofy. But anyway, you can see this comet in the night sky. So look up in your, might be a daily newspaper in your area, or you could look up online. It's C2022E as in Edward, E3. And so, and it'll tell you where to look up in the night sky to see it. Very visible. Maybe use binoculars. And just one caveat, do not ever look at the sun with a telescope or optical equipment or even your eyes. So this is late at night viewing with a small, with the handheld binoculars. Or if you're using binoculars, it's always good to have a tripod mount for it. So it's very stable and you can let it sit there. And because it's very hard to hold binoculars and keep it focused on something. Anyway, so the green comet, C2022E3, up in the sky tonight. And so if you go out there tonight, like I say, look for your local listings. And luckily, we do not have a bright moon in the night sky, in the evening sky, so you should have a nice clear vision of the night sky. We're in the what's called the waning crescent phase of the moon, where the moon is out, it's going around, it's approaching the new moon phase, and so it's not going to be in the evening sky to obstruct your vision. Okay, before I forget about it, I want to talk about my new book. If you haven't ordered it yet, you should. It's something that came together very quickly out of necessity, because I just keep hearing these. In fact, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't see something on the internet or a new interview, and where these people are talking about 12,000 years ago, something hit Earth and caused all of this destruction. And they come with a lot of really, really good information. All kinds of references to ancient things that indicate that there were extensive civilizations on Earth, very advanced civilizations on Earth that went asunder, and just literally not a trace of them anymore. And then some civilizations emerged and lived in these same areas, like the Egyptian pyramids or like the Mayan ruins that were then rebuilt by the Mayans on the old gridwork, etc. I've talked about that, my experience going down into the Yucatan in the mid-1990s. Remember, I'd lived in Mexico City when I was a young person. Let me see, what would be my age at that point? Probably 22, 23. It was right after I got out of college instead of going to grad school. I said, I'm just not ready for grad school to go sit and stick my nose in a physics book. I had been very successful at my graduate career, my undergraduate career in mathematics, physics. But I just was like, okay, I got to do something different. So I went to Mexico, got a job teaching, and spent a couple of years there exploring Mexico, beautiful country, the Mayan ruins, the Aztec ruins, archaeology, etc. Very interested in that. And then when I was in the mid-90s, so that was in like 1971. So literally almost 25 years later, I go back to Mexico with surveying equipment because I knew these areas. I had been in them, Chichen Itza and Uxmal and Palenque and Tulum, etc., and a lot of these cities. So I went back to do surveying on the ground with surveying equipment, and that's back in the old transit days with a little telescope, etc. And I ended up with the knowledge that these cities were built on the old gridwork. So that's published in my early work, the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, etc. and that the old North Pole had been up around the Hudson's Bay. What I, the way I put it was north of the state of Michigan in Canada, in Ontario. And so, and that was a better reference because a lot of people are not that familiar with Hudson Bay, you know, that type of thing. But anyway, that was the end effect. And so I've been involved in this for decades, literally, in the archaeological understanding, and that there was a massive earth change of some kind where there was a physical pole shift. And so anyway, all of a sudden, this new wave of people come along, and they're claiming that a comet hit Earth 12,000 years ago and caused all this devastation, everything in the kitchen sink, when we know there were various events. There was the Moses-Venus event, the Moses leaving Egypt with the Israelites, and then that was the Venus event when Venus, the comet, came by that the Mayans talk about. Then there was the Noah's flood, which was a totally separate event thousands of years earlier, etc. And so anyway, now this group is coming along and saying, oh, a comet hit Earth, and it was 12,000 years ago, which is way out of date. And then they want you to believe things like a place called Göbekli Tepe, which is in Turkey. It's a site that was discovered actually quite a long time ago, but they realized that this was a major hub of civilization, potentially millions of people living in this area. And the claim they're making is that the people lived there, these millions of people, they took all of their stuff, you know, that would be related to living, you know, pottery or spoons and dishes and food production, whatever it was, and removed it all, and then covered the city with dirt. And I was like, what? I mean, how bizarrely absurd a claim. Just bizarre. But this is getting fostered on talk show hosts, talk shows and things like that. Absolutely bizarre. So anyway, I said, okay, it's time for me to come out with this book. It's called The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. So it's $19.95 on my webpage. Not going to say anymore. I recommend that you go get it and read it. And if you buy any other product on my webpage, you'll get the book for free. So anyway, people have been responding to that, purchasing water filters, purchasing grow towers, purchasing other book sets or my education package, etc. So whatever else product that you purchase, you will get the book for free. Okay, so on to the next topic. I want to jump back. At the beginning of the show, I was talking about the divorce rate, the people in prison, that all of these issues that are related, these statistics. But the question comes up, what is the solution? Where did we go wrong? And here's another statistic that I want you to combine with what I was talking about before. Now, remember the statistic that the people who committed crimes, now this is a certain segment of society, but it also relates to people who don't commit crimes and have issues with social development, is that they didn't have a father figure in their life it's a different figure than a mother figure. And if they didn't commit violent crimes and end up with 10 or 20 year prison sentence, there's still a lot of issues that people have when they don't have a base family life with a father and a mother in the home. But here again, if you look at education in the United States, 85% of the teachers in kindergarten, preschool, primary, and secondary education, 85% of the teachers are women. Now, if you are coming back to a nurturing point of view, there's been a complete breakdown in society where, the traditional norms in the base of the family Now, you have to also include this statistic, which actually shocks me, because when I went through college, of course, I had visions of getting married to my girlfriend and having kids and stuff like that. And anyway, it was just like, you know, there was something about it that I didn't like. And then really that's when the statistics in that time frame started to really come out and show that the vast majority of women who have college educations who get married end up divorced, and they initiate the divorce. So the issue comes back, and then the whole issue of kids having problems because they're raised, because what happens in a divorce? The guy's got to leave. He's thrown out. He's out on wherever. He's someplace else. He's paying the bills, paying for the house, paying for the kids, paying for the education, but he ain't there. And maybe he gets a weekend, every other weekend, he gets a few hours. And so the kids really don't have a father. And one thing that came out of the same study was that the women have very low self-esteem. And this is a problem because a society needs strong women. It needs women who understand who they are, and they don't have a problem just recognizing themselves and having self-esteem comes from somebody who's there to support you. When you do something, you fall down, you skin your knee, somebody's there to give you a hug, pick you up, say, okay, you're tough, you're okay, you're going to be fine, or whatever it is. There's that balance, and it comes out in the statistics. It's not me talking, it's the statistics talking. So not only is there not a male presence in the home, but there's not a male presence in the school. The males that are in the school, what are they teaching? They might be coaches, they might teach a history class or something like that, or they might be, say, a principal, or they might be in administration, something like that. But there's really, literally, no contact with men in the education system. So kids go from preschool to kindergarten to grade school to high school and don't have any male influence at all in this society. And if you look at other societies that were, say, successful, the Greeks during their epic high culture time, they talked about the complete person. And there you had men that were very involved in education. The complete person in the Greek sense was physical, mental, spiritual, and in terms of understanding mathematics and logic and reasoning and debate, all of these things, which doesn't happen anymore in school. And what happens is kids are taught a whole bunch of unrelated facts that they memorize, and if they can regurgitate them on a test, they get an A, and they think they're smart. When in reality, they're not being taught to reason, to think, and so when society comes at them, or the world controllers come at them with whatever it is, the baloney that's thrown at kids today is just unbelievable. Much worse than when I was growing up, I guarantee you, 100 times, 1,000 times worse. And the cell phones and TikTok and the superstar images and all of this stuff, all being thrown at these kids, and they're trying to sort out who they are with all of this massive amount of influx of information coming at them, and a lot of it is very distorted. Wow. I mean, when I was young, there was no TV even, there was a little bit of radio, but I mean, we spent most of our time doing other things, and there certainly was no cell phone where people were just locked. I went to an event, it was a couple of months ago, and these people were relatives. They were all like cousins and things like that. The kids sat there the whole time, all of them, looking at a telephone and playing with their phone the whole time, all of them. I'm like, oh my God, these kids can't talk. They have no association with each other. they don't say anything. They might say hi when they walk in the door or something like that, but they have absolutely no communicative skills at all with their family members. I'm shocked. I guess I'm not shocked, but I mean, it's at a state where the society has, I would say in the United States, has completely broken down. And there are so many people that live with this now that they think that that's reality, the new reality. Okay, well, I'm going to jump off that topic now, but I wanted to add the issue that there's no male presence in education today, for all the way up to K-12, kindergarten, preschool, whatever it is. And then on top of that, now I have my own education package, which I highly encourage people to go and purchase and then implement that in your house. And I don't just, it's not just for the kids. The first thing I tell the parents is that you have to look at this yourself and learn it. And then you work with the kids to understand the education program. But the very first thing it does is it lays down some rules of the road where you have to understand who you are, that you're that you have a spirit, that you're an individual, that you're different than everybody else, that you have value, that other people are going to be different than you, etc. And it lays down some ground rules that are very specific that have been totally removed from school today. Today in school, kids learn that they're all the same. You have to be guilty for the color of your skin. Little boys are supposed to be little girls. Little girls are supposed to be little boys. It's just a confusing mess from a bunch of adults who have basically fallen off the deep end. So at any rate, I was going to get to some other science topics. I'll get to them next week. But what an important topic where people have to realize that they've got to grab a hold of their families, and very few families are going to make it out of this in one piece. A lot of people are moving out into the country, getting away from the school systems, taking their kids out of school systems, literally. Don't send your kids to a public school, period. And there might be some good ones, but wow, it's just infiltrated with garbage. And there might be some good private schools out there, and there's been a huge effort in building private schools that meet the standards of parents who are very concerned. Okay, well, I'm out of time for this week. Just remind you, go to my web pages, jmccwaterfilters.com. You can get a 10% discount using the coupon code JMCC. And then the main web page, jmccsci.com. And just go there, spend some time, and I'll see you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.